Epilogue. Remember the old saying. The red-walled room, its ceiling painted fancifully with birds and fish cavorting among clouds and waves, bustled with brown-clad clerks scurrying along the aisles between the long tables that covered the floor. None seemed to be trying to listen. Most seemed stunned with cause, but Suroth disliked their presence. They had to overhear some of what was being said, and it was potentially dire news. Galgan had insisted, though. They needed to work to keep their minds off the disastrous news from home, and they were all trusted men and women. He insisted. At least the white-haired old man was not dressed as a soldier this morning. His voluminous blue trousers and short, high-collared red coat with rows of gold buttons embossed with his sigil were the height of Shandar fashion, which meant the height of fashion for the Empire. When he wore armor or even just his red uniform, he sometimes looked at her as if she were a soldier under his command. Well, once Elbar brought word that Tuon was dead, she could have Galgan killed. His cheeks were smeared with ashes, as were hers. The ship Semirag had promised had brought word of the Empress's death and the Empire racked by rebellion in every quarter. There was no Empress, no daughter of the Nine Moons. To commoners, the world trembled on the brink of destruction. To some of the blood, too. With Galgan and a few more dead, there would be none to object to Suroth Sabel Mel'Darrath proclaiming herself Empress. She tried not to think of the new name she would take. Thinking on a new name beforehand was bad luck. A frown creasing his face, Galgan looked down at the map spread out before them and placed a red lacquered fingernail atop mountains on the southern coast of Arad Doman. She did not know what the mountains were called. The map showed all of Arad Doman and held three markers, one red wedge and two white circles, spaced out in a long line north to south.
Has Turan gotten an accurate count of how many men came out of these mountains to join Iteralda when he crossed into Arad Doman, Yamada?
Ephraim Yamada wore the ashes too, since he was of the blood, if only the low blood, his hair cut in the bowl and tail, rather than a narrow crest across an otherwise shaved scalp. Only the commoners around the table, whatever their rank, were without. Graying and tall in a blue and gold breastplate with broad shoulders and lean hips, Yamada still held some of the beauty of his youth.
He reports at least 100,000, Captain General. Perhaps half again that. And how many came out after Turan crossed the border? Possibly 200,000, Captain General.
Galgan sighed and straightened.
So Turan has one army ahead of him and another behind. Very likely the whole of Arad Doman's strength, and between them he is outnumbered.
The fool, stating the blindingly obvious.
Turan should have stripped Tarabon of every sword and lance, Suroth snapped. If he survives this debacle, I will have his head.
Galgan quirked a white eyebrow at her.
I hardly think Tarabon is loyal enough to support that just yet, he said dryly. Besides, he has Damani and Rakan. They should offset his lesser numbers. Speaking of Damani and Rakan, I've signed the orders raising Tylee Kirgon to Lieutenant General and the Low Blood, since you've dithered over it, and orders to return most of those Rakan to Amadisia and Altara. Trison still hasn't found whoever created that little mess in the north, and I don't like the notion that whoever it was is lying in wait to spring out as soon as Trison returns to the Mulvain Gap.
Suroth hissed, gripping her pleated blue skirts in her fists before she could stop her hands. She would not let the man make her show emotion.
You overstep yourself, Galgan, she said coldly. I command the Forerunners. For the time being, I command the Return. You will sign no orders without my approval.
You commanded the Forerunners who have been subsumed into the Return, he replied calmly, and Suroth tasted bitterness.
The news from the Empire had emboldened him. With the Empress dead, Galgan intended to make himself the first Emperor in 900 years. It seemed he would have to die by tonight.
As for you commanding the Return,
he cut off at the sound of heavy boots from the corridor. Suddenly, Deathwatch guards filled the doorway, armored and hands on their sword hilts. Hard eyes stared out of their red and green helmets to survey the room. Only when they were satisfied did they step aside to reveal that the corridor was filled with Deathwatch guards, human and Ogier. Suroth barely noticed them.
She had eyes only for the small, dark woman in pleated blue with a shaven head and ashes on her cheeks. The news was all over the city. She could not have reached the palace without hearing of her mother's death, her family's deaths, but her face was a stern mask. Shiroth's knees hit the floor automatically. Around her, the blood knelt. The commoners prostrated themselves.
"The light's blessings for your safe return, Highness," she said in chorus with the rest of the blood.
So Elbar had failed. No matter. Tuon would not take a new name or become empress until the mourning was finished. She could still die, clearing the way for a new empress.
"Show them what Captain Musenge brought me, Banner General Kareed," Tuon said.
A tall man with three dark plumes on his helmet bent to carefully empty a large lump from a canvas bag onto the green floor tiles. The gagging smell of decay began to permeate the room. Dropping the bag, he strode across the floor to stand beside Suroth. It took her a moment to recognize Elbar's hook-nosed face in that rotting mass, but as soon as she did, she fell forward, prostrating herself, kissing the floor tiles. Not in desperation, though. She could recover from this, unless they had put Elbar to the question.
"My eyes are lowered, Highness, that one of mine has offended you so deeply that you took his head."
"Offended me?" Tuon seemed to be weighing the words.
"It might be said he offended me. He tried to kill me."
Gasps filled the room, and before Suroth could more than open her mouth, the Death Watch Guard Banner General planted a boot on her bottom, seized her crest in his fist, and hauled her upper body clear of the floor. She did not struggle. That would only have added to the indignity.
"My eyes are deeply lowered that one of mine should be a traitor, Highness," she said hoarsely.
She wished she could have spoken naturally, but the cursed man had her back arched till it was a wonder she could speak at all.
"Had I even suspected, I would have had him put to the question myself. But if he tried to implicate me, Highness, he lied to protect his true master. I have some thoughts on that, which I would share with you in private, if I may be allowed."
With a little luck, she could lay this to Gulgon. His usurpation of her authority would help. Tuon looked over Suroth's head. She met Gulgon's eyes, and Abeldar's, and Yamada's, and those of every one of the blood, but not Suroth's.
"It is well known that Zyred Elbar was Suroth's man completely. He did nothing that she did not order. Therefore Suroth Sabel Mel'Darroth is no more. This Darko Vale will serve the Death Watch Guard as they wish, until her hair has grown enough for her to be decent when she is sent to the block for sale."
Suroth never thought of the knife she had intended to use to open her veins, a knife beyond reach in her apartments. She could not think at all. She started screaming, a wordless howl, before they even began cutting her clothing off. The Andoran's sun was warm after Tarvalen. Pevara removed her cloak and began tying it behind her saddle as the gateway winked shut, hiding the view of the Ogier Grove in Tarvalen. None of them had wanted anyone to see them leaving. They would return to the grove for the same reason, unless matters went very badly wrong, in which case they might never return. She had thought this task must be carried out by someone who combined the highest diplomatic skills with the courage of a lion. Well, she was no coward, at least. She could say that much of herself. "Where did you learn the weave for bonding a warder?" Javindra asked abruptly, stowing her own cloak in similar fashion. "You should recall that I once suggested Red Sisters would be well served by having warders." Pevara snugged her red riding gloves, showing no concern for the question. She had expected it before this. "Why would you be surprised I know the weave?" In truth, she had needed to ask Yukiri, and had been hard-pressed to dissemble her reason for asking. She doubted that Yukiri was suspicious, though. A red bonding a warder was as likely as a woman flying. Except, of course, that was why she had come to Andor. Why they had all come. Javindra was there only at Sutama's command, given when Pevara and Tarna could not come up with enough names to suit the highest. The angular sitter did not bother to hide her displeasure over that, not from Pevara, although she had buried it deeply around Sutama. Tarna was there, of course. Pale-haired and icy cold, her keeper's stole left behind, but her divided gray skirts embroidered in red to the knee. For Elida's keeper to have a warder would be difficult, though the men were to be housed in the city, away from the tower. Yet it had all been her idea in the first place, and she was, if not eager, then determined to take part in this first experiment. Besides, the need for numbers was paramount, because they had found only three other sisters willing to entertain the idea. The primary task of the Red for so long, finding men who could channel and bringing them to the tower to be gentled, tended to sour women on all men. So the clues had been few and far between. Jezreel was a square-faced tyrant who kept a painted miniature of the boy she had almost married instead of coming to the tower. His grandchildren would be grandparents now, but she still spoke of him fondly. Dasala, a beautiful Kyrianin with large dark eyes and an unfortunate temper, when given the chance, would dance any number of men to exhaustion in a night. And Melair, plump and witty with a love of conversation, sent money to Andor to pay for her grandnephew's education, as she had for her nephews and nieces. Weary of searching out such tiny clues, weary of probing delicately to learn whether they meant what they might, Pavara had convinced Sutama that six would be enough to begin. Two, a larger party might cause some unfortunate reaction. After all, the whole Red Aja appearing at this so-called Black Tower, or even half, might well make the men think themselves under attack. There was no telling how sane they all still were. That was one thing they had agreed on behind Sutama's back. They would bond no men who showed any signs of madness. That was, if they were allowed to bond any. Aja eyes and ears in Camelin had sent copious reports on the Black Tower, and some had even found employment inside it, so they had no difficulty locating the well-worn dirt track that led down from the city to a grandiose double-arched black gate near 50 feet tall and 10 spans wide, topped by crenellations over a down-pointing central spike of stone and flanked by a pair of thick crenellated black towers that stood at least 15 spans high. There were no actual gates to close up the opening, and the black stone wall that stretched out of sight east and west, marked at intervals by the foundations of bastions and towers, was nowhere higher than 4 or 5 paces that she could see. Weeds grew along the uneven top, and grasses ruffled by the breeze. Those unfinished walls, looking as if they might never be finished, made the gate seem ludicrous. The three men who stepped out into the opening were not at all ludicrous, however. They wore long black coats and swords at their hips. One, a lean young fellow with curled mustaches, had a silver pin in the shape of a sword on his high collar, one of the dedicated. Pavara resisted the instinct to think of him as equivalent to an accepted, and the other two as novices. Novices and accepted were kept safe and guided until they knew enough of the power to become Aes Sedai. By all reports, soldiers and dedicated were considered ready for battle almost as soon as they learned to channel, and they were forced from the first day, pressed to seize as much of Sidene as they could, made to use it almost continually. Men died from that, and they called it training losses, as if they could hide death behind bland words. The thought of losing novices or accepted in that fashion curdled Pavara's stomach, but it seemed that the men took it in stride. "A fine morning to you, Aes Sedai," the dedicated said with a small bow as they reined in before him. A very small bow, never taking his eyes from them. His accents were those of Murundi. "Now what would six sisters be wanting here at the Black Tower this fine morning?" "To see the Mahale," Pavara replied, managing to avoid choking on the word. It meant leader in the old tongue, but the implication of taking that alone as a title gave the word much stronger meaning, as if he led everyone and everything. "Ah, to see them hail, is it? And of what Ajahs, should I say?" "The Red," Pavara replied, and watched him blink. "Very satisfying, but not very helpful." "The Red," he said flatly. He had not remained startled very long. "Well then, and Kazan, Alcine, you keep watch while I see what the Mahale has to say to this." He turned his back, and the vertical silvery slash of a gateway appeared in front of him, widening into an opening no larger than a door. Was that as large as he could make? There had been some discussion about whether to bond men who were as strong as possible or those who were weak. The weak might be more easily controlled, while the strong might, would definitely, be more useful. They had reached no consensus. Each sister would have to decide for herself. He darted through the gateway and closed it before she had a chance to see more than a white stone platform with steps leading up one side and a squared-off black stone that might have been one of the building blocks for the wall, polished till it shone in the sun, sitting atop it. The two who remained stayed in the middle of the double arch as if to bar the sisters from riding in. One was a Saldaean, a skinny, broad-nosed man just short of his middle years, who had something of the look of a clerk about him. A bit of a stoop as from hunching for long hours over a writing table. The other a boy, little more than a child, who raked dark hair out of his eyes with his fingers, though the breeze quickly put it back again. Neither seemed the slightest uneasy over confronting six sisters alone. If they were alone, were there others in those towers? Pevara refrained from glancing at the tower tops. "You there, boy," Dasala said in a voice like Chimes. Chimes tinged with anger. The surest way to set off her temper was to harm a child. "You should be at home with your mother studying your letters. What are you doing here?" The boy flushed bright red and raked hair from his face again.
"Samuel's all right, Aes Sedai," the Saldaean said, patting the boy's shoulder. "He's a quick learner, and you don't need to show him anything twice before he knows it."
The boy stood up very straight, pride on his face, and tucked his thumbs behind his sword belt. A sword? At his age? True, a noble's son would have been learning the sword for several years at Samuel Alcine's age, but he would not be allowed to wear the thing about.
"Pevara," Tarna said coolly, "no children. I knew they had children here, but no children."
"Light," Miller breathed. Her white mare sensed her agitation and tossed her head. "Certainly no children." "That would be an abomination," Jezreel said. "No children," Pevara agreed quickly. "I think we should wait to say more until we see Master... the Mahale," Javindra sniffed.
"No children what, Aes Sedai?" Enkazin asked, frowning. "No children what?" he said, when no one answered. He no longer appeared so much like a clerk. The stoop remained, but something in his tilted eyes suddenly seemed dangerous. Was he holding the male half of the power?
The possibility sent a chill down Pevara's spine, but she resisted the desire to embrace Sidar. Some men who could channel seemed able to sense when a woman was holding the power, and Kazin looked like he might be hasty now. They waited in silence except for the occasional stamp of a hoof, Pevara schooling herself to patience, Javindra grumbling under her breath. Pevara could not make out the words, but she knew grumbling when she heard it. Tarna and Jezreel took books from their saddlebags and read. Good. Let these Ashaman see that they were unconcerned. Only not even the boy seemed impressed. He and the Saldaean just stood there in the middle of the gate, watching, hardly blinking. After perhaps half an hour, a larger gateway opened and the Murandian strode through.
"The Mahale will be receiving you at the palace, Aes Sedai. Go on through."
He jerked his head toward the opening.
"You will show us the way," Pevara said, dismounting. The gateway was larger, but she would have had to crouch to ride through.
"There'll be someone the other side to guide you," he barked a laugh. "The Mahale doesn't associate with the likes of me."
Pevara filed that away to chew over later. As soon as the last of them was through, near the white stone platform with its mirror-bright black stone, the gateway winked shut, but they were not alone. Four men and two women in rough woolens took the reins of their horses, and a dark, heavy-set man with both the silver sword and a sinuous red and gold figure, a dragon on his tall black collar, gave them a minimal bow.
"Follow me," he said curtly in a Tyran accent.
His eyes were like augers. The palace the Mirandian had spoken of was just that, two stories of white marble topped with pointed domes and spires in the style of Saldaya, separated from a large space of bare, hard-packed ground by the white platform. It was not large among palaces, but most nobles lived in buildings far smaller and less grand. Broad stone stairs rose to a wide landing in front of tall, twinned doors. Each bore a gauntleted fist gripping three lightning bolts, carved large and gilded. Those doors swung open before the tyrant reached them, but there were no servants in evidence. The man must have channeled. Pavara felt that chill again. Javindra muttered under her breath, with a sound of prayer this time. The palace might have belonged to any noble with a taste for tapestries showing battles and red and black floor tiles, except that there were no servants in evidence. He had servants, though unfortunately no red Aja eyes and ears among them, but did he expect them to remain out of sight when not needed, or had he ordered them from the halls, perhaps to avoid having anyone see Six Aes Sedai arrive? That line of reasoning ran towards thoughts she would rather not consider. She had acknowledged the dangers before leaving the White Tower. There was no point dwelling on them. The chamber the Tyran led them to was a throne room, where a ring of spiral-cut black columns supported what must have been the palace's largest dome, its interior layered with gilt and half-filled with gilded lamps hanging on gilded chains. Tall, mirrored stand lamps stood along the curved walls, too. Perhaps 100 men in black coats were standing to either side of the room. Every man she could see wore the sword and the dragon, men with hard faces, leering faces, cruel faces. Their eyes focused on her and the other sisters. The Tyran did not announce them, but rather simply joined the mass of Ashaman and left them to make their own way across the room. The floor tiles were red and black here, too. Taim must particularly like those colors. The man himself was lounging on what could only be called a throne, a massive chair as heavily carved and gilded as any throne she had seen, atop a white marble dais. Pavara focused on him, and not only to avoid feeling all those eyes of men who could channel following her. Mazrim Taim drew the eye. He was tall, with a strongly hooked nose and an air of physical strength about him, an air of darkness, too. He sat there with his ankles crossed and one arm hanging over the heavy arm of the throne, yet he seemed ready to explode into violence. Interestingly, though his black coat was embroidered with blue and gold dragons that twined around the sleeves from elbows to cuffs, he did not wear the collar pins. "Six sisters of the Red Aja," he said when they stopped short of the dais. His eyes. She had only thought the Tyran's eyes were augers. "Plainly you didn't come to try gentling us all." Chuckles rippled around the room. "Why did you come asking to speak to me?" "I am Pavara Tazanovni, sitter for the Red," she said. "This is Javindra Dorila, also a Red sitter. The others are Tarnar Fayir, Dasala Navanshi." "I didn't ask your names," Taim cut in coldly. "I asked why you came here." This was not going well. She managed not to take a deep breath, but she wanted to. Outwardly, she was cool and calm. Inside, she wondered whether she would end the day forcibly bonded or dead. "We want to discuss bonding Ashaman as warders. After all, you've bonded 51 sisters against their will." As well to let him know they were aware of that from the start. "We do not propose bonding any man against his will, however." A tall, golden-haired man standing near the dais sneered at her. "Why should we allow Aes Sedai to take any m—" Something unseen struck the side of his head so hard that his feet left the floor tiles before he fell in a heap, eyes closed and blood trickling from his nostrils. A lean man with receding gray-streaked hair and a forked beard bent to touch a finger to the fallen man's head. "He's alive," he said as he straightened, "but his skull's cracked and his jaw's broken." He might have been talking about the weather. None of the men made any move to offer healing,
not one. I have some small skill in healing, Melair said, gathering her skirts and already moving toward the fallen man. Enough for this, I think, with your permission. Taim shook his head.
You do not have my permission. If Mishraila survives till nightfall, he'll be healed. Perhaps the pain will teach him to guard his tongue. You say you want to bond warders? Reds?
That last word carried a great deal of contempt, which Pevara chose to ignore. Tarna's eyes could have turned the sun to an icicle, though. Pevara laid a cautionary hand on the other woman's arm as she spoke. Reds have experience with men who can channel. Mutters rose among the watching Ashaman, angry mutters. She ignored that, too. We are not afraid of them. Custom can be as hard to change as law, harder at times, but it has been decided to change ours. Henceforth, Red Sisters may bond warders, but only men who can channel. Each sister may bond as many as she feels comfortable with. Given the green, for example, I think that is unlikely to be more than 3 or 4.
Very well.
Pevara blinked in spite of herself. Very well? She must have misunderstood him. He could not have been convinced so easily. Taim's eyes seemed to bore into her head. He spread his hands, and it was a mocking gesture.
What would you have me say? Fair is fair. Equal shares. Accept very well and ask who will let you bond them. Besides, you must remember the old saying, let the Lord of Chaos rule.
The chamber erupted with men's laughter. Pevara had never heard any saying like that. The laughter made the hair on the back of her neck try to stand.
The end of the 11th book of The Wheel of Time.